Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, everybody. Seth Meyers here. Welcome to another edition of Late Night Lit, our monthly podcast series celebrating books and authors. Here to discuss what's new in the world of books is Late Night's own literary expert, Sarah Jenks Daly. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, and welcome to Late Night Lit. This is our last episode of 2021, and we're closing out the year with two exceptional guests. First, bestselling author Jason Mott, whose latest novel, One Hell of a Book, recently won the National Book Award for Fiction. We also speak to Kathy Gordon, Marketing and Publicity Director at Legacy Lit, a Hachette Books imprint dedicated to amplifying the voices and stories of underrepresented individuals. Jason Mott is a best-selling author of four novels and the newly minted winner of the National Book Award for Fiction for his most recent, Hell of a Book. It's an incredible read and one that he conceptualized, considered, and worked on for years before bringing it to the page. It mainly follows an author on a book tour, a situation Mott is intimately familiar with, but also weaves in other narratives and characters to create a complete story, one that incorporates themes of fame, public perception, and what it means to live as a Black man in America. I loved listening to Jason talk about not only the novel, but how he, as the author, had to reckon with the overwhelming reception of a book that he told us he wrote mostly for himself and never really believed anyone else would read. I hope you enjoy it too. Here's my conversation with Jason. Today we are joined by New York Times bestselling author and the newly crowned winner of the National Book Award for Fiction, Jason Mott. Jason, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Congratulations on all this acclaim for this novel, which is called Hell of a Book, and it is. And I was kind of wondering, how many times have you been in interviews where people have said the title and then said that?
I lost count a long time ago. It has become like the running gag, but it's fun. I enjoy it. That's awesome.
As long as it's still funny to you.
It is. It completely is.
So this is your fourth novel, and it was inspired, at least in part, by your own experience as a Black author on a book tour, out on the road, promoting your story. Can you give just a little background on how the idea came together?
Sure. So it started back in 2013 when I was on book tour for my first novel, The Returned. I had about a 6-week or 2-month period of just being constantly on the road, and it was such a bizarre, shocking, kind of wacky experience that I found so much humor in it. And then I just wanted to write about that because, you know, I came back from the road and I would like tell people about it. Like they just loved hearing about it. And so I wanted to write about it. My agent and editor were both at the time like, nah, nobody wants to hear about an author on book tour. Nobody wants to read about that stuff. So I put it away, and then you fast forward a few years, like almost like 7 or 8 years. And I kind of took it and melded it with some other stuff that I had going, and Hell of a Book came out of all that.
And you mentioned that you got some feedback that nobody wanted to hear it. So was that also part of the reason you kind of put it aside? Did you believe that that was true in a way?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely, there was a pragmatic reason for putting it aside as well. You know, I still owed my publisher, you know, X amount of books. And so I had to be writing on those. And so even though I pitched it and, you know, so once I pitched it and they kind of weren't really interested in it, it's like, okay, let me find the idea that you guys do like and work on. And then later when I was between projects and I was pitching it to my agent, she just kind of was very lukewarm on the idea. And so in her defense, like the manuscript at that time that I kind of showed her was dramatically different than what Hell of a Book turned out being. But eventually I got to the point where I decided, you know what, I really love this idea and I really need, not only want, but need to write it. When I told my agent that, she said, okay, do what you need to do. Like, because she's very supportive in that type. She says, go write what you need to write. And Hell of a Book came out.
When you say dramatically different, can you explain in what ways it was?
Yes. So the original version of this was very much a kind of just pure slapstick comedy about an author on book tour. It lacked all of the personal space, all the personal details, all of the racial discussions that occur in the book. And as you know, as people who read the book, like, that is a massive part of the novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
So imagine a version of this where it's literally about half of the things that are there are present. So that was where it began. It was just kind of a framework for this idea. And I like to think that's part of why, I mean, I think even I knew something was missing from it at that time. I just didn't know what it was. Because as much as it was fun reading about this author on book tour, it still just lacked something that I couldn't quite put my finger on. And so that's part of the reason why I didn't mind putting it away so much. But eventually, as I, you know, in the wake of a lot of the tragedy that were showing up in the news and on television, and friends and I were talking about trying to just sort through, that's when I decided to go back in and say, well, I've got all these thoughts on America and on being Black and on being a writer, and I need to find a way to, like, talk about that. And I remembered this author on book tour project that I enjoyed writing, and that became a way for me to have fun doing the writing. And so I just combined the two together.
Also, it must have been sort of meta in terms of your own writing catharsis, if mm-hmm. that was a thing for you, and also what the characters go through in terms of a catharsis and kind of seeing those two things happening at the same time.
Yeah, it was. It was really difficult to navigate from a writing standpoint. And also from just a personal standpoint, I am someone who is an extreme introvert. Like, I do not like crowds. I do not like being the center of attention, which is, you know, once you win the National Book Award, you get all kind of attention. But it is something I have struggled with from a very, very, very long time, dating back to my childhood, where I don't do well when I'm in the spotlight. I've gotten better about it for sure, but it is still a place where I struggle. And so writing the book and having that meta component and seeing so much of my reality on the page, not just purely fictional stuff, but so much of my reality on the page, that's part of why so much of the book is this space where memoir and fiction are kind of, you know, dancing together, because it gave me this kind of plausible deniability where when I felt too visible, I could pull back on the writing and pull back from myself. And it just kind of gave me a way to be visible, but also hide myself and be invisible at the same time.
Well, I was going to ask this later, but since you brought it up, I read this interview where you talked about the practice of invisibility and becoming invisible as feeling like something you had perfected in your own life. I think that kind of works its way into particularly this passage that I wanted you to read about Soot in the book. One of the characters is called Soot by some not very nice classmates. But is that something that was particularly personal for you writing that?
Yes, that was extremely personal. Like that component, that wanting to disappear, sums up a massive swath of my personality and by proxy my life and like the way I've kind of conducted myself. Like, I am the guy who does the, you know, the disappearance at a party. You know, when a party's happening, you, like, people just look and I'm gone. Like, I never say goodbye because even that feels too visible. You know, I'm that person who I try to blend into the background in almost all things that I've done in my life. For better or worse, I think there are times when it's helped me, but there are times when it probably has, you know, hindered me more than anything else. Because, you know, eventually, if you're always in the background, your voice never gets heard. And like so much of who you are gets just ignored and unseen by people. So yeah, that component is very much a part of my personality and who I am, and I still struggle with it very much.
Yeah, I would imagine too, if your voice isn't heard, then maybe the perception of who you are comes to the front, and that perception might not even be accurate.
Exactly. That's definitely something I kind of grapple with, like just understanding who I am versus who I think I am, which is something we all kind of struggle with to a point. But that's definitely a major thing that I kind of have struggled. I've for so long, I've told myself that I am this small kind of insignificant person who doesn't really have a voice. And now I find myself kind of trying to break out of that and say, no, I do have a voice and I'm going to be visible and, you know, stand in front and say these things. It's a very strange place to be in.
Yeah, I bet. Well, if you wouldn't mind reading that section from the book, it's early on in the book, but I think really kind of defines who that character is and how we learn about him.
Sure. Do not mind at all. So yeah, this is from pretty early in the book, like first chapter, when Soot and his parents are playing this game where he tries to become invisible. "I did it," the boy exclaimed. "I really did it." "Did what?" his father asked. "I was invisible." His parents' eyes went wide as starred magnolias. "No," his father exclaimed with joy, looking very dramatic, like TV people again. "You really did it?" his mother asked, equally elated. "Yep," the boy chirped, almost laughing. "I was in the living room this whole time, unseen, just like you said. It really worked, Mama." Then his mother hugged him, and the three of them danced and laughed and smiled like they never had before. In that moment, the worries that had always hung over their heads were suddenly gone. It was as though all three of them might suddenly levitate off the floor, float up into the blue sky that sprawled itself out long and wide above the small country house that the family called home. The next day, the boy, still drunk on sweets and wonder, asked his father, "You really couldn't see me, could you?" "It doesn't matter if I saw you or not," his father said. "All that matters is that you felt safe."
So beautiful.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering also, going back to being such a part of this book, was it completely surreal to have it come to life and then go on the road to promote it and do a book tour for it? Like, had you considered that piece of it?
So it's funny, like during the writing, I was definitely aware of how like the levels of meta that were kind of playing out in the process of it. And the fact that, you know, you'd have to go on book tour and talk about the book tour book. And like, there were just so many layers to it. But if I'm honest, like when I was also writing it, I honestly thought no one would read it. I kind of thought it was just going to be the great flop where I wrote it and nobody bought it. And it just became this thing I put in a closet somewhere. So that's what gave me the freedom to just say, screw it and have fun. Because like, I really thought I was just writing something for myself because I couldn't imagine people actually liking the book because it was too strange and too weird. So yeah, so that's kind of how I was expecting failure and somehow stumbled into success.
Extreme success.
Yeah, say. Exactly.
Based on the reactions from everyone, do you feel that what you wanted to write about, and in addition to the humor, what you wanted to explore in terms of race in America and chaos, do you feel like you conveyed it in the way that you've been hearing from people who've read it?
I do. And that's been really gratifying. Like so much of this book, like the reason it kind of functions in this absurdist space is that it was designed to kind of just capture the emotions and the feelings of, you know, being on book tour, but also just being Black in America, like the conflicted emotions that kind of occur there. And so I had to sacrifice a lot of like detail and realism in favor of this space of imagination and absurdity where I could kind of pull the emotions out. And I was always worried that people would either be upset that there isn't enough realism or maybe just not get the emotional kind of impact that I wanted. But readers across the board like have just been really resonating with it and really finding all the things that I wanted them to find and feeling the emotions I wanted them to feel. And it's truly unbelievable. Like I just never expected it to kind of connect with people the way it seems to be connecting.
Lastly, Jason, we typically conclude interviews by asking for recommendations from our guests. So if there are any books that you've recently read and love that you would be willing to share, we'd love to hear them.
Sure. So like I recommend this a lot throughout the last year because I think people need to read it. But it's a book called Monsters by Barry Windsor Smith. It's a graphic novel that came out back in April, I think it was. I've been a big fan of his work for decades. And this is a project that he's been working on for literally about 20 some years. And it finally came out and it is glorious. So I recommend that. I recommend Black Buck by Mateo Ascaripor. And then for, you know, one of my old reads is Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. It falls under the fiction, under the philosophy category, but it's a book that kind of guided a lot of my life. So I always recommend that to people.
Oh, that's excellent. We'll definitely check those out. Thank you so much for taking the time today. It was so nice to talk to you.
No, thank you for having me. This was wonderful.
We'll be right back with Kathy Gordon.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Kathy Gordon has been a force in the publishing world for decades, constantly searching for ways to reinvent what literary marketing and branding looks like. And in her current role as marketing and publicity director at Legacy Lit, she's continuing this journey at a place that seems perfectly suited for her. Although the Hachette Books imprint is in its infancy, Kathy's enthusiasm for storytelling and highlighting the voices of those we don't always hear from are driving forces behind the exceptional books Legacy Lit will be publishing in the coming months. Now here's my conversation with Kathy. Hi everyone, we're here with Kathy Gordon, the Marketing and Publicity Director of Legacy Lit. Thank you so much for joining us, Kathy.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I thought we could start with Legacy Lit, which is a Hachette Books imprint, which was officially announced a little over a year ago. Is that right?
Yeah. I think we celebrated our anniversary, our unofficial anniversary, at the end of October. Yeah.
So can you first talk about what the goal of the imprint is, like what types of books you've already published and will publish and what kind of stories you are all hoping to tell over there?
So the official mission statement, if you will, for Legacy Lit is an imprint dedicated to marginalized and underserved voices. So that is, as we define it, our BIPOC community, LGBTQIA+. And these are not just stories written by these folks, but stories with, you know, these themes as well. We have a healthy backlist because the publisher was, she was a publisher at Hachette. And she was publishing some of these kinds of books before there was an actual imprint dedicated to it. So it arose out of a need for an imprint like this. We need more books like this. We need more voices like this. We need more submissions. So there are a couple of titles on our backlist that we have published into paperback format. But our official first title was in November. It was November 9th. The book was called Cis Don't Settle by Judge Faith Jenkins. She's the presiding judge on Divorce Court, the syndicated Fox show. And she is also married to R&B singer Kenny Lattimore. So this made for a wonderful publication in that we did all kinds of exciting out-of-the-box kinds of promotion. We did a city winery book tour, which was amazing. So there was concert and conversation. So she would be in conversation with someone and chat about the book. And then he gave a full-on concert. So definitely worth the price of admission.
Yeah, I bet. You spend the majority of your career in publishing. I know that. But you also are a person who has worked a lot with branding opportunities and cultivating different ideas, like out of the box, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. for events and in terms of just promoting literature.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how those two worlds mesh for you?
Yeah. So I was hired as a publicity director for Legacy Lit. And then we quickly learned that I also have a lot of marketing expertise since my previous job was director of brand development at HarperCollins. And I found that that job did not exist in publishing prior to me. And so it was straddling what we know as traditional book marketing and traditional book publicity in this sort of made up but necessary position called brand development. So it's not titled marketing where it's like, oh, hey, the book's on sale. Let's make some postcards. It's not getting press for specifically that title. It's all kinds of things throughout the year to keep the author and the book relevant. So one of the things that I did that I'm still probably the most proud of was a fan fest for one of my authors, a fiction author who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, but she was a New York Times bestselling author. She had 16 books under her belt. And at book 15 or 14, we decided to do a fan fest where we brought all of her fans together, those who could make it to South Carolina, where she was from, where she wrote about the Lowcountry, so that they could experience the Lowcountry with her. And it was a weekend of conversation and fun and different things that didn't necessarily have to do with the book, but they let you get to know the author and the themes that she writes about. So we had a cooking class, we had mint juleps, we took a jazz cruise, but these just brought the fans closer to the author. And I find those experiences are absolutely amazing and priceless because that's what they want. You know, they buy the book when it goes on sale, they buy it in every format, they buy multiple copies for friends. And they don't want to just have their book signed. They want to spend time with the author and understand why she made them feel so good. So I love doing that. I love bringing readers closer to their authors, not just through the pages, but through their personalities.
Yeah, that's so great. And that's so true.
Yeah.
Especially when a book touches somebody, all they want to do is have a conversation about it.
Absolutely.
Particularly with the person that wrote it.
Particularly with the person who wrote it, for sure. They want them at their book club. In fact, Dottie and I traveled to a book club. We did a contest where you could win a visit with the author. So there we were in Michigan in the dead of winter. And I was like, couldn't we have picked a reader from Hawaii? Unfortunately, no one submitted from Hawaii. So there we were in Michigan in a lovely home. And we had great conversation with the book club about her books.
That's so great.
Yeah.
So you've spent the majority of your career in publishing, obviously, which we talked about, and many different sectors of this, which you just mentioned. What made you want to enter this field and what made you want to stay in it? Because it's been a few decades where you've been thriving in this arena, and it's certainly not an easy job.
No, it's not. And it changes daily. So I was a journalism major and I just loved writing. I love reading. I love reporting. I love telling stories. And this was, you know, it was one of those roads that I went down. I said, well, let's see what publishing is like. And I got to read so many stories and share so many stories and impart like the important themes without sitting there and, you know, reading a book to people. And it resonated. And then I think that I would have to credit probably all of my publishers for giving me the freedom to make my job what I wanted it to be. So I took marketing up another level. You know, why don't we do this? I think I've never been afraid to ask questions and see where it would take us. And luckily they were willing to sort of fuel some of my crazy ideas that turned out to be things that we did ongoing. So I think that's why I stayed. I love the people. I love the editorial team. I think that they're just brilliant in the way they can turn a manuscript into something that we all want to read. And it's not easy at all. But in working together, you know, combining all of those skills, you know, yours, the editors, the publicists, and getting that book out there is such a labor of love. It's literally like giving birth. Like, it's like you wrote the book yourself.
I think probably an exciting part, too, of Legacy Lit, in the sense of that you getting kind of to define your job in so many different ways, is it's very cool to be a part of something at the beginning, where even though there are a lot of unknowns, like I felt this way when we started Late Night, it's new and you get to kind of be a part of defining what it is and maybe what it will be.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm enjoying about Legacy Lit, because while I have, you know, sat down with, we have these agent meetings, we called it our Legacy Lit tour at the beginning of, well, a little bit before this season's books, we just sat down on Zooms like this one with multiple people at agencies and talked about the kinds of books that we want to see, the kinds of books we want to read, what we think our consumers want to read, and how we were going to go about getting to them. So we were going to be a little untraditional in that, yes, our sales reps sell to booksellers, but we want to talk to booksellers ourselves. So we wanted to put together, and we are, next year, roundtables where we discuss with booksellers, BIPOC booksellers, all booksellers, what they want, what their consumers are reading, and what would they like to see more of. We're doing the same thing with the press. We'll have virtual media lunches. So in a way, I am marketing the books and publicizing the books every single day, but I'm also marketing the brand and creating the voice that we would like people to hear.
That's great. That's really great. I know you work closely with the publisher and the whole team, it seems, in order to curate this list of titles mm-hmm. and authors. Are there certain titles that you're particularly proud of or excited about that are coming up that you can tell us about or that we can look forward to?
Oh my gosh, yes. So one of them that I'm currently working on comes out in April. It's called Grief is Love. And it is by Marissa Renee Lee, who is an entrepreneur. She is a grief expert. She was formerly in the Obama administration. She's just the total package. She's somebody that when you talk to her, first of all, she has all this love and light when you speak to her. So that always feels great. But you're just not really sure how she's been able to accomplish so much in her young life. And this book is about dealing with loss, but understanding that you need to hold space for it and that your life can go on after losing someone, but you're not just supposed to get over it. And we spend a lot of time thinking, oh, this thing happened to me, but now maybe people are sick of hearing about it and I need to buck up and just sort of fix my life. And it doesn't go that way. And I think I'm personally attached to this book because Marissa lost her mother to MS and she also had a fertility issue. So she lost a pregnancy. She has recently adopted a child, which is wonderful. But I lost my mother in 2016 and she was one of the closest people to me ever. And so I don't think that I've dealt with mine either. I don't think that I've given myself space. And it's particularly rough in December because she was born on December 19th and she passed on December 23rd. So it's grief during the holidays. So while this book is coming out in April, it has themes that resonate, I think, your whole life. But it's, you know, again, understanding that you need to honor your own place in it and your love for it with the same attention that you gave to the person when they were alive. And I think that it's an amazing message and she's already getting a lot of wonderful feedback. And so that's gratifying when you know that something is going to hit and then you hear it hit and it is, and it's resonating. So that's a good feeling.
Oh, I'm looking forward to reading that one.
Yeah.
One of your other titles, Made, is already a New York Times bestseller, right?
Yes, several times over.
And also a huge Netflix title.
Yes. Yeah, it's a limited series on Netflix. Yeah.
What has that been like seeing at these early stages of the imprint, this title come to life and then also seeing it simultaneously on television? Did you guys anticipate what a hit it would be? And did new readers come and find the book because they had watched the show?
Oh my gosh. Yes. So many new readers and they comment daily in social media. They write directly to Stephanie Land. She's a pro, but I would feel overwhelmed, but it's so gratifying. I think with anything, you hope that it's going to be a hit. I mean, I think that about any book that I publish, right? We all are chasing the New York Times bestseller list, even though we tell our authors like, that's not a barometer. You really want to, think about what people are saying and, but we all know that it is.
Well, hopefully they're not listening to this, Kathy.
Well, I hope they are. But, the New York Times bestseller list is a barometer and it is important. And she was already a New York Times bestseller for the title in hardcover. And, as with any powerhouse that is a Netflix or, any TV series or movie, you get more readers. You're putting it out there. They're able to see it in a different format. And so, of course, it would come with that. But I don't think that any of us expected. I was away at a wedding in Nashville, and I found myself in my room when I should be, like, enjoying all the people looking at Netflix to see what was number one that week and if it was Made. And we were just behind Squid Game. So I knew that that meant something, when it's not just readers you're talking to, I mean, I was a Netflix binger over the pandemic. And so just realizing what this audience loves and wants to receive. And I was blown away by the series. I think that they did an amazing job from page to screen. So yeah, it's been incredible. And she gets requests for media every single day.
That's so cool. That's so great. Lastly, I'd love to end with any books that you would like to recommend, either that you've recently read or that are also coming out on Legacy Lit.
Oh, wow. There's so many. Yes, there are two. One is Black Boy Smile by Dee Watkins. Dee is the New York Times bestselling author of The Beast Side. And this book is a memoir in moments. And so it's about his life growing up on the streets of Baltimore, where, he was urban. He's a kid in the streets. He didn't have a lot. He was running with the wrong crowd. At one point, he was a drug dealer, sporting, all that went with that. But he found books and he found writing and he found a love for it, so much so that he enrolled in writing classes and, you know, was rejected a few times. But, you know, if it finally hit, he is the editor at large at Salon. He is a professor at Johns Hopkins. He has a family. He has a lovely wife and a beautiful daughter. And it's just a story about figuring out your way through Black trauma to find Black joy, which is a big theme. And it's not something that's readily given to urban Black men to cry, to be in touch with their feelings, to understand. I mean, I guess maybe you're sensing a little bit of a theme here with some of our books, is that we really put great sensitivity into themes like holding space for the things that are dear to you in your heart. And only that way can you give more. So I think that we all believe that this is Dee's breakout book. It's an amazing read. The stories are gritty. Like, you put yourself in them. Like, there are little points in the story where you can actually smell the food cooking and you can hear the neighbors laughing and you get joy from that. So, that's coming out in May.
Great.
And then the other one is Inheritance by Baynard Woods. Baynard is a memoir of my whiteness. So this follows the successful trends like white fragility and white trash, but it's from an alternate perspective. It's told through the lens of a Southern white male when he learns that his family was involved in the slave trade for decades. And so it's a reckoning with white privilege, and it's really raw, and it's an amazing narrative. He's a great storyteller, and it's, you know, it's authentic. It's all coming from the heart. This is his family story, and that's out in June.
Oh, great. Well, I'm looking forward to both of those and everything else you guys are publishing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Sarah, again. My digital producer, Jay Johnson, requested a book recommendation from me to close out the year. And although it's taken 18 months of hosting this podcast for him to finally ask, I jumped at the chance. So here we go. I was first introduced to Hanya Yanagihara's work through my friend Rakesh Satyal in late 2015. He showed up to meet me carrying a copy of the book, A Little Life, to which I replied, "Am I really that boring to you?" He assured me that it was not me and that the book was one he just couldn't put down. I got a copy soon after and proceeded to read 800 plus pages in 72 hours. I stayed up until 2 a.m. reading, I woke up early to read, and I also read during work. Sorry, Seth. A Little Life remains one of the greatest pieces of literature I have ever read. And when I pitched the idea of Hanya coming on late night to talk to Seth, Hanya, through her publicist, told me I was crazy. In her defense, this was in the early stages of our show featuring novelists on Late Night, and the subject matter of A Little Life is not typical talk show fodder. But she conceded, and of course, it was wonderful. A Little Life is a book that I continue to recommend, and so when I was given an early copy of Hanya's new novel, To Paradise, thank you, Todd Dowdy, I was ecstatic. Since it's not yet out, I won't give much away, but I will say this. It is a story told in three parts set in New York City over the course of two centuries, in 1893, 1993, and a dystopian 2093. And all three stories are connected to a townhouse in Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village. I was so profoundly moved by the structure and the scope, by Hanya's deep understanding of loneliness and loss, how she writes about what it means to take care of someone, and what it means to understand when you no longer can. And how time doesn't always necessarily bring progress. She is a master storyteller, and it is a prescient and beautiful book. To Paradise will be published on January 11th, 2022, and I'm thrilled that Hanya has agreed to come back on Late Night to chat again with Seth on publication day. If you're able, pre-order To Paradise now, and if you can, do that with your local or favorite independent bookstore. It's remarkable, and the world of literature is infinitely better with Hanya in it. This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Jason Mott, Kathy Gordon, Matt Ryman, Jay Johnson, and Ross Leupold. Our theme music was written and performed by the 8G Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly. Thank you for listening. Happy reading and happy new year.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.